Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council begins its mandated redraw of voting districts with new data from the 2020 census. We look at the three maps up for discussion and hear about where the state is in their process. Mecklenburg County changes COVID testing rules as one major hospital system suspends 375 workers for defying their vaccination mandate. Mecklenburg County Commission begins discussions of what's next for Latta Plantation, which was closed last summer because of a controversy over a planned Juneteenth celebration. And we also get an update on voter ID, the ACC baseball tournament, new hope for the Eastland Mall site, and the streetcar running on empty. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's political reporter Steve Harrison. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Joe Bruno, fresh off his appearance in Charlotte Squawks, reports for WSOC TV, Channel 9. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. Hello to you.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg breathes a sigh of relief for not having to guest host this edition of the Roundup. being merely a contributor this morning, he's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mike. I'm glad your show's still intact, despite my presence last week.
Yeah. Every 10 years, thank you for doing it. I appreciate it. Every 10 years, we take a census as mandated by the Constitution, and one of the reasons for that is to get a snapshot of the population, where they live, et cetera, so that voting districts can be drawn. The process is now underway using data from the 2020 census, and Charlotte City Council is among the first to debut new maps that they are considering. A city council committee released those maps. Why three maps? Steve.
So there is, like you said, a special redistricting committee that looked at four maps earlier this week. They kind of rejected one quickly. And then there's the first map is a map that has kind of the least change, and that's kind of presented for the making the fewest changes we could do. And then the other two maps were done, which appears to be what the full city council will be picking from. The big headline from those maps, I think, is that they both kind of protect or continue to give Republicans a slight advantage in the two district seats that they hold. That, you know, this is a 9-2 council. And going into this process, there was some thought or some concern among Republicans that the maps might push them down to just one seat. Mm-hmm. But the way it looks now, it looks like Republicans will have at least the chance to win two, as they have now.
And yet I read a description of these maps somewhere yesterday that said one of the three maps does pose a potential threat to Republicans. Does that still stand, Joe? I mean,
that would be map A. It's the minimum change map. Brings in precinct 77 into district 6, and precinct 77 is over there near Arrowwood Road. That's kind of near Nations Ford Elementary. That's a district that voted for Biden in 2020. It was like 1,200 votes for Biden, 100 votes for Trump. So, you know, that's a presidential election. So that's more people probably turned out for that race than would for a Charlotte City Council race. But that precinct itself does tilt D. Tark Bakary still would have a shot at winning District 6 as a whole, though. It could have been a lot worse for him.
But because even in the two districts, or even in the two Republican districts, it's still, they're what, 30%? I mean, it's not an overwhelming Republican district, if I'm making sense there.
But Steve, you said the two maps they are most likely to choose from, map B and map C, give the Republicans a better chance. And this is a democratically controlled city council. There are only two Republicans on city council, none on county commission. Why are they favoring a map that gives Republicans a better shot? The legislature doesn't work that way.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, you know, one thing, that the maps were drawn by former city attorney Mac McCarley, who seemed to kind of follow McCarley and his team seemed to follow this idea of the city criteria, which was, you know, quote, communities of interest. And so he interpreted that as the idea of like District 6 in South Charlotte around South Park is Republican and right-leaning unaffiliated as their own community of interest. And so the question will be, city council can change these maps. Will they tweak them? Will they make adjustments? I think one thing that's going on here is that a lot of Democrats on council, they don't mind having two Republicans. Republicans, they don't drive the agenda. They probably enjoy some of the balance. It gives them, I think having some Republicans on council gives, like remember a couple of weeks ago when council passed the non-discrimination ordinance unanimously with Republican votes, that helps. That helps to have a bipartisan move on some controversial issues. So I don't think there's any real push by many of them to just completely drum the GOP out.
And in fact, Democrat Malcolm Graham, who chairs this redistricting committee for city council, made a point of saying they're leaning toward these maps that favor keeping Republicans in office.
We're going out our way to try to create a map that's fair and balanced and takes both parties into consideration.
It sounds so novel in this day and age that somebody would say that. That's interesting. In fact, there are certain criteria, I understand, that these maps must meet. For instance, all districts have to have substantially equal populations. The courts have ruled that districts should be reasonably compact to avoid gerrymandering. Districts may, however, follow neighborhood and cultural lines. Aside from those rules mandated by the courts, who made up the rest of them?
So that was the city council that has set these guidelines. You know, it's interesting. The city council said, if you kind of compare their guidelines, the new guidelines of the state, the city council said they would use race as a factor, not a predominant factor. The state has said it won't use race at all. So there were a few changes, but it was a council decision. And again, going back to what I said earlier, they interpreted it, Mac McCarley, and it seems like council is leaning toward interpreting that South Charlotte is a community of interest, just as West or East Charlotte, and that's kind of led you to this 9-2 map.
Mary.
It's interesting, though, because even though they said race can be used but not predominant as a factor, not predominate as a factor, but a little bit of partisanship can be there, though not gerrymandering. But in truth, both in the state and in the city redistricting, you can see that it often correlates, and it's used by politicians to interpret Black and minority communities as Democratic and the communities of interest, say in South Charlotte as Republican, as also predominantly white. And the maps also point out the fact that we still have in Charlotte, though you don't have legal segregation, you have the legacy of segregation. So many of the communities do break down when you look at it on the basis of race.
When the younger members of city council first came to power several years ago, we referred to them as the Young Turks, and we had a few of them on the program, among them Tariq Bakari and Braxton Winston. But in recent months, Tariq and Braxton seem to be on opposite sides of most issues. As you mentioned, Steve, Tariq was predicting that this new map drawing would remove Republicans, including himself, from power. That doesn't seem to be the case nor the intent at the moment, however. But Democrat Braxton Winston has a problem with these proposed maps. He called the redistricting process a hypocritical farce. Why?
So he wants to, what I believe that he wants to do is create maps. He feels like that the maps that are being proposed kind of reinforce the traditional or the historic crescent and wedge. You have two wedge seats in affluent South Charlotte. Everything else is in the crescent. Braxton Winston thinks it should be jumbled up, that we should be maybe aligning these based on transportation corridors and neighborhoods that maybe at first don't have a lot in common. And so I think there's a lot of good in that idea, and it's a different concept. The problem is it probably would result or maybe result in an 11-0 Democratic council, and that would pose a lot of problems for the city in terms of Raleigh. Would Raleigh step in? And so there would be some unintended consequences of him jumbling things up like he wants to do.
Joe.
this map that he had the consultant create was based on the idea that every single district should have a transit corridor running through the district. And that was really challenging for the map makers to create because, you know, our highways and our transit options are few and far between. The other issue that they ran into with his map was the criteria of a transit corridor running through every district. That wasn't part of what council agreed to when they chose what they were going to make these maps based off of.
There has been one public meeting, I understand, about these maps where the maps were available to the public to look at, and they continue to be available to the public to look at. You can go online and see them. But I read your Twitter stream, Joe, and mm-hmm. one of your followers made the comment, "I can't bear to look at the maps." What has been public reaction so far?
You know, I don't think a lot of people are surprised that Charlotte City Council would take the not controversial route, if that makes sense. I think that people would have been, this would have gotten more attention if they went along with Councilman Winston's idea of dramatically changing the boundaries. The thing with District 6, because that has gotten the most attention, Tark Bakari will have a shot at winning it, but there's by no means is it a guarantee. It gives a Republican a shot to win that district, but the demographics in that district are changing in a way that a competitive candidate could give the Republican a run for that seat.
So there'll be two more meetings on this, October the 5th and again on October the 18th. That latter meeting will be part of a city council meeting. When will they're coming up to a deadline. When will they have to make that final decision on these maps?
Must be approved, what, November 17th?
November 17th, yeah.
Okay. And the first public hearing will be October 5th. And then October 18th during council, people will have a chance to give their opinions.
So,
you know, I was just going to piggyback real quick on what Joe said about the city changing so quickly. I mean, in 10 years, we could be having this discussion about, you know, the new redistricting then, and it won't matter at all because the entire city, even at local city council races, may be blue. I mean, there may not be a way to draw any map to give a Republican a chance. So this is, in a way, kind of the last hurrah for the GOP to have, could be, I say, to have representation on council.
Well, you're seeing this national trend in many states of these very blue cities, and in states, even very red states all over the country. And so it's presenting this conundrum for them.
How is the position of the national GOP, which seems to be completely in the pocket of Donald Trump and completely consumed with contesting the last presidential election, how is that going to impact suburban Republican districts like the South Park area going forward at the local level? Are they likely to be tainted? They don't want to be tainted by that, or will they just vote Republican because they are Republicans?
It might, I think, depend on who the candidate is and who the choices are, what the choices are. It's interesting when you look at the breakdown, how many independents there are in the state and in the city and in the country. And particularly, I think they're up for grabs. Like this last election, you saw suburban white women in particular be repulsed by some of the policies. And this is where policies such as the abortion bill in Texas, I think, will come into play. Will the state start adopting these very strict rules or not?
Trigger warning, the state is also drawing maps. And we're going to talk about that process and what they're coming up with, because we're going to get a 14th congressional district, and nobody knows yet where it will be or how they will draw that district. But we'll talk about that and many other things as the local news roundup continues in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On this local news roundup edition, Steve Harrison is here from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg, the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis, host of the Equal Time podcast for Roll Call, for which he also writes a column. And Joe Bruno, reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9. So North Carolina is also beginning their map drawing progress. or process. I can't bear to look. Given our track record, we're going to look anyway. And apparently there is a problem for some voters. About 100 people came to a public forum this week where they asked North Carolina legislators to refrain from gerrymandering political maps. How was that request received, and how likely are they to not gerrymander? Who wants to take that?
Mike, I feel like you're asking questions you may already have answers to. let's just put it this way, that the last time around, we basically spent, 10 out of 10 years in court fights about what was decided in terms of redistricting. And I don't really see any way that we're going to avoid more of that in the future because of what you just outlined. One person's gerrymandering is another person's perfect situation.
Yeah.
And you have a Supreme Court that has signal that they really aren't going to interfere in issues of partisan gerrymandering. And as I said before, even though they said you really can't racially gerrymander, the way it's worked out is they kind of also fall along the same lines. And it's really crucial because this next House race, the Democrats hold a very slim majority. And really, Republicans can overtake the majority by just gerrymandering or just redistricting the seats that different states are getting. And North Carolina is a battleground state, and they have this one seat. And so, yes, there are going to be fights in court over whether the redistricting is about gerrymandering, particularly since the state legislature controls it. I believe that Governor Roy Cooper cannot veto.
He cannot.
This is going to be a big fight.
Joe.
It was an interesting public hearing. That's what it was, a public hearing. So there was an opportunity for the lawmakers to engage. It was just person at the microphone telling what they would like to see. And then the next person got up there and spoke. There wasn't a whole lot of talk about where the 14th congressional district should go. You teased that that's one of the new things with these maps. We get an extra person in our delegation, but there wasn't a whole lot about where they think that extra district should go. One speaker said, I hope you don't do what Dallas Woodhouse is saying you might do and make a 10-4 map. There was a lot of talk about communities of interest. Some interesting comments, like one person said, I consider Lake Norman to be a community of interest, so you should put Davidson, Cornelius, and Mooresville, and you should lump them all together. Susan Hardin got up there and spoke and said, you should not split colleges. You should keep all universities intact, keep them together as a community of interest.
I was just going to say, to Mary's point, I mean, and how fragile these majorities are, remember, up until a few years ago, North Carolina was 10-3 in Congress. Then you had the decision in 2019, the court decision, and then it's 8-5. So that's why people are fighting so hard about this.
So you just mentioned the comment from John Lingle, who spoke with he spoke at that meeting from Davidson about keeping the North Mecklenburg towns together as a voting block. And I believe he also told that to our own Steve Harrison.
But if one of the three towns like gets spun off into an Iredale district, it's going to be very, very tough to try to advocate for the community interest, because you essentially have to start going to two different legislatures on it, or two different senators.
And you also spoke with Angela Lunking, Steve, who wants more public hearings once the draft maps are released.
And the only way we can do that is by seeing the initial drafts of the maps, having input from everyone, because at the end of the day, if it's a fair map, it's not going to make everyone happy. It's going to piss everybody off. But if we know that the process was fair and the process was correct, then we can all unite in unity and restore the trust.
Is restoring trust top of mind for these legislators, Steve, and those who will sign off on these maps? Or is the only thing that matters here political advantage?
I mean, I think a little bit of both. I definitely, of course, a political advantage. You have to, if you're a Republican drawing these maps, you are not going to give away too much. But I do think North Carolina Republicans don't want to go through the decade of litigation that we had before. One interesting thing about this meeting, like Joe said, a public forum for legislators to hear people's thoughts. Paul Newton was there. He's a Republican senator from Cabarrus County who co-chairs elections. He's a very key player, right? But really, he was the only key player because everyone else up there was the Mecklenburg delegation. 16 of 17 of them are Democrats. So you had this forum where people were preaching to the choir, essentially saying, you know, that talking to people who really, to be frank, don't really matter in this process.
Wow. In the past, too, as Eric said, before this legislation or the litigation, you saw a willingness to split up colleges, as folks said, split up cities. You had a time where the city of Asheville, because it was split, was represented by two of the most conservative members of the House, conservative Republicans. So people are going to be not having a lot of good faith as they're examining the process to start. Perhaps, Joe, as Steve said, you know, people will want to have this process look fair, but they're going to be going in with a lot of skepticism.
And they sometimes draw these districts in such a way that it's very clear what they're trying to do, because they're ridiculously shaped districts that sometimes stretch through like a snake through the state. And you reported, Joe, that one North Carolina District 9 resident made a plea for the district not to stretch from Charlotte to Robeson County because the needs of both areas are so different. Was that question necessary because that's being proposed or because of historical precedent?
I think just historical precedent. I mean, you can take, you've got South Park Mall, and then you can go all the way into Marshville and then Robeson County. The needs of the Lumbee tribe are very different than the needs of the people who are shopping at Louis Vuitton in South Park Mall.
When are these maps due for review and or for formal acceptance, adoption?
I don't know the exact date, but filing is in December, right? Okay. So for the soon. March primary. So this is going to be pretty quick. We're going to knock this out soon.
You may have noticed that for the first time in a very long while, we did not lead this roundup with COVID news, because although hospital ICUs are clogged around the state with mainly unvaccinated COVID patients, the curve does appear to be flattening, but people are still fighting mask and vaccination mandates, although 99% of Novant Health's 35,000 workers have complied with their vaccine mandate. The hospital system this week suspended 375 employees for being out of compliance. They have a choice: get the shot or get a religious exemption by September 15th, which was several days ago, or take a weekly COVID test. Clearly, they didn't meet the first two requirements. Are these folks also refusing to take the test? Who knows the answer to that? Anybody?
I don't have any information that they're refusing to take the test.
So what's the problem here? They're not taking the test and they're not vaccinated, correct?
Yeah, I mean, they must not be submitting test results if they're taking the test, because otherwise they wouldn't be suspended, correct?
Well, the announcement was made on Tuesday, this announcement that about the suspensions, and those employees had 5 days to comply. That day is tomorrow, Saturday, or they will be fired. Do we have any idea what has happened in the days since Tuesday?
No, not yet. But it's also my understanding that they were kind of given like this last final chance that they to start their shot series or they will be terminated. So, you know, they've been pretty good with providing media updates on the status here. And I honestly think that the number is very low compared to how many people work. Like, this is something that should be celebrated, that so many people, I know they were going to be fired if they didn't do it, but still, they complied with this mandate.
It's 375 out of 35,000 employees, so that is pretty impressive.
So Mecklenburg County is also changing its testing rules for unvaccinated employees. That's in the wake of the county's suspension of 598 workers. That's 13.5% of the workforce, for failing to upload weekly COVID test results. Apparently, this is changing because County Manager Dina DiOrio said there was confusion about the original rules.
So employees did not know when they'd have to start that 7-day clock again, because they did not know when their test results would be available. So we walked away from that, and we're now just requiring one test every 7 days between Sunday and Saturday each week.
But she said that no employee was wrongfully suspended. She made the statement, "Employees who are in this situation put themselves there." why the understanding about the apparent confusion on the one hand, but strict constructionist view on the other?
It was a challenging policy, and it was rolled out in a confusing manner. A lot of the people who were suspended made good faith efforts to actually get tested, but then it came down to they didn't get their test results in time, or maybe they were off because they were confused by the 7-day rolling test period. So now it's a lot easier to understand. The county is allowing the employees to have time to get tested even during their lunch break. And the testing period is from Sunday to Saturday. Now, just every week, you only have to submit your test, that proof that you got the test. You don't necessarily have to submit that test result unless you're positive.
Eric.
I thought it was notable that despite what Joe just said, suspended employees will not receive back pay. And then the second thing I would say, which is more of asking a question, does anybody know through all this, Mecklenburg County Public Health from, you know, they were one of the first, they said you have to have the vaccine, period. Why the different policy for public health versus Mecklenburg County employees? Has anybody heard the reason for that?
Not yet. So the health department obviously mandated the vaccine because they're dealing with patients in a medical setting. I don't think it's ruled out in the future that this could be a county-wide mandate for employees, but right now they are giving people a shot at just getting tested weekly. It's not an easy policy to follow on principle. Testing is a very, you know, it's not fun to get tested every single week. So I think the county wants to see if more people choose to get vaccinated to avoid the hassle of getting tested every single week.
And I mentioned that 598 workers were suspended, but you also, Joe, reported this week that 86 remain suspended, which says that some of those people got the tests and they're out of suspension now. Most of the employees who remain suspended work in the Park and Recreation Department. Do we understand why?
No. A lot of them are part-time in the Park and Rec Department, so I'm not sure if it's a situation where they aren't necessarily as plugged in to the Park and Rec role as maybe another job that they have. But it is a level of concern for some leaders that that number is even as high as 86, that the county may have to lose 86 employees the next week or two. These people haven't submitted anything. The county manager, the county hasn't heard from them at all. Dina interprets that to mean they don't want to work for the county anymore. They don't care if they lose their job over this policy.
A mask mandate also went into effect, I believe it was on Wednesday, for churches, synagogues, mosques, and other houses of worship in Mecklenburg County. There's been at least one instance of pushback by an area church. Is that continuing, or are we assured that most all churches will comply with this?
Here's the thing, though, Mike. I mean, even if they don't comply, what's going to happen to them? There has been no enforcement of the mask mandate. The county is asking people to please follow this and not punishing people if they don't. So there hasn't been any lawsuit. I haven't even heard chatter about a lawsuit. And I'm wondering if that's because they know that this mask mandate isn't being enforced.
Meanwhile, it looks like it's mainly voluntary. I think they're still very hesitant with this issue of church and state.
Okay. Meanwhile, Union County School Board voted this week to modify their quarantine protocols to comply with state law and to let the County Health Department lead contact tracing efforts. This followed a threat of legal action from the state's Department of Health. Catch us up on that. What caught the state's eye, and what were they threatening to do?
Union County basically said, if you don't have symptoms, you have to be in the classroom. They were stopping. The Union County schools shifted all of the contact tracing to the health department and said, if you don't have a quarantine order, we expect you to be inside the building and learning. That, of course, brought a lot of concern from people who, you know, are worried about their kids being exposed to COVID, because Union County is not mandating masks. And the high number of people having to quarantine was because there were positive cases in the classroom and they were all together in that maskless situation. So the state sent a letter saying, hey, you guys have to do this. You have to at least tell the kids to quarantine if they're exposed. If you don't, we're going to take some legal action. And we found out earlier this week at the Union County meeting that legal action would have been an abatement order of imminent hazard, something similar to what the county did with the United House of Prayer last year, where they got a legal document saying, yo, you have to shut down because this is a health risk.
So I was under the impression that the Union County School Board was taking these actions and making these decisions because they were being pressured by parents to do that, that the parents wanted this. But what you just said indicates that there are enough parents out there who are concerned about these actions that they wanted the state to step in. So what's the story here?
How do you really gauge how many parents are for or against something? You know, it's tough. I mean, but yes, there are a lot of parents who want Union County Schools to remain mask free. They actually want kids to be able to go into the classroom if they're not sick. So yes, there are parents who are upset that their kids will have to miss time in the classroom because of a positive exposure.
Meanwhile, Cleveland County says it is in crisis. The county health director and a doctor from Atrium Health Cleveland held a news conference this week because county leaders wanted residents to hear it straight. You reported on this, Joe. What did they say?
Well, it was interesting. The first thing that the county leader said was, you know, we are in a state of crisis right now, but this press conference is not going to be about you having to do anything. So like that signaled to me, like, this wasn't going to be about you should wear a mask, you should get a vaccine. They just wanted people to know the current situation in Cleveland County with their hospitals. And we heard from a doctor at Atrium Health Cleveland who said, you know, approximately half of all of the beds in Cleveland County hospitals are filled with COVID patients. They're having to send COVID patients to the Kings Mountain Hospital now. At sometimes they're postponing like non-life-threatening surgeries. They're having to reroute patients because there's just no room for them. And they're double bunking people in the ICUs at times. So it was kind of, you know, a sobering announcement specific only to Cleveland County, which I think is helpful because a lot of time us here in Charlotte are only focusing on the Charlotte hospitals.
Well, last week, 90% of the ICU beds there were taken by COVID patients. This week, the number is 40%. I have 5 seconds. Why this announcement now then? Okay, I'll think about the answer. We'll come back after the break and you can give me an answer. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We are here with Steve Harrison, our political reporter at WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis with Roll Call, Eric Spanberg with the Business Journal, and Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV. The buzzer beat him to an answer in the last segment, so I'm going to ask the question again. Last week in Cleveland County, 90% of the beds at Atrium Health Cleveland, 90% of the ICU beds were taken by COVID patients, but this week it's only 40%, and they held this press conference to let people know that they were taking patients who were coming in and taking and sending them to other hospitals because they have no more room. Why, if the patient load is declining, why this announcement now?
It took me more than 5 seconds to figure out how to answer it in 5 seconds. But listen, cases are still
time's
elevated
up
in Cleveland County.
Next.
And as we know, hospitalizations, you know, they can change quickly. So while it is a good stat this week, we need to continue to monitor things because it could be 70% next week.
So on the lighter side, WBTV originally reported a story that has since appeared on CNN about the efforts of David Oakley of Boone Oakley Advertising in Charlotte. On Sunday, as fans were gathering on street corners as they were walking to the stadium for the game, Boone Oakley had created a traveling billboard by painting a truck with the message, "Don't get vaccinated," on all sides of the truck. It was sponsored by a fictitious funeral home. Because, you know, if you don't get vaccinated, you may be paying a visit. But the message was the antithesis of what David Oakley was trying to drive home.
A lot of the advertisements that you see right now for pro-vaccine are very simple, like get the shot, get vaccinated. We wanted to do something that saw things from a different perspective. So the idea came about when we thought about who would really benefit from people not getting the shot. And you kind of go back to the simple fact that people are dying that aren't vaccinated. So who benefits from people dying? A funeral home.
In addition to the story making it on CNN, photos of the truck went viral, and Oakley says if that truck causes one person to get the shot, it was worth it.
Any advertisement that like is provocative is going to create a dialogue. And if when you get people talking, people have action. And I'm hoping that the action is that people will get a shot because of this.
Okay, so moving on from COVID, last summer, the anger raised by a controversial event planned by Historic Lata Plantation to celebrate Juneteenth led to the site's closing by Mecklenburg County. Now the county is re-examining what they want to do with that property. First, remind us of the controversy that led to its closing and the cancellation of the contract between the county and the operators of the site.
Well, it was a celebration or ceremony for the Juneteenth holiday marking the abolition of slavery, enslavement in Texas. And it was actually about white refugees. And they talked about, quote, MASA. And it was really offensive to a lot of people that, particularly on this holiday, that you would have a celebration that seemed to actually take the side of the slave owners. It was quite the controversy.
Yes. Advertising promised stories, quote, from the MASA himself and other, quote, white refugees.
Yes.
I guess because they were upset by the downfall of the Confederacy. The county ended the contract as a result of this with the entity that had been running the day-to-day operations. What are they considering now in terms of how that facility might reopen, who would run it, what kinds of improvements would be made, what kind of programming would take place at Lata Plantation going forward? Anybody know? Joe?
Well, they're trying to figure that out. There is a group that has been formed that includes historians, NAACP President Corinne Mack. They're going to meet throughout the rest of the year to decide how they want to proceed with Historic Lata Plantation. They also may invest a couple $100,000 between now and whenever it reopens to renovate the site, add security cameras, maybe pave some lots, add internet access to this 16-acre site. Just to prepare it more for when the public is able to go there once again.
As long as you're talking, Joe, I know that you have been keenly interested in Charlotte's Gold Line streetcar. You've been hugging those tracks. You've been hugging those tracks closer than the wheels on the streetcar itself for several years. You were among the first to ride the streetcar when it finally opened. And the trouble is, you might have been the only person to ever set foot on it. Evidently, ridership numbers on the streetcar are low. How low can they go?
Hey, Jim, before you answer, just remember that it is a huge exorbitant fee of $0 and 0 cents.
That's right. It's free to ride.
For now.
Yes.
Now, the September ridership numbers aren't available yet, but the first couple days it was open in August, people really weren't rushing to get on board.
Well, is that because they're not rushing to go anywhere because people are still working from home? There aren't. If you go downtown in the middle of the day, the parking lots are fairly empty.
Possibly. It also isn't very convenient to ride during the times when people can go downtown or are going to the games and stuff. Like at one point, I think this past weekend, they had to make it every 40 minutes instead of every 20 minutes because of the labor shortage. During the Duke's Mayo Bowl, the Georgia-Clemson game, my wife and I tried to take it home. It was non-existent and didn't show up. I don't know what happened there. I looked at the fair equity analysis that Katz produced because now they're talking about charging $2.20 starting in January. The original projection for the streetcar is 1.2 million people riding it a year. And then with a COVID adjustment, it's about 356,000 people. It just still seems incredibly high at this point. Those are very wishful figures.
Ridership on transit almost everywhere in the country is down right now, I think because of the pandemic, and it's certainly down on the Lynx Blue Line. It's down on the bus system as well. And you mentioned the frequency of service. Is this just a matter of figuring out how to do this. How many streetcars are actually running? Because it takes about 35 minutes. This thing is in traffic. It has to stop at traffic lights. It has to stop if the traffic is backed up. It takes about 35 to 40 minutes to go from one end of the 4 mile run to the other. And if you miss the train, I'm not sure when the next one comes. Does it just go one way and turn around and come back? Is there only one vehicle?
No, there are a couple on the line. Okay. But during this, so they held a public hearing to ask the public what they think about raising the price to 20. Only one person spoke. And
his name was Joe.
Joe, only one person showed up.
He was the rider.
He's the guy riding the train after you got off, that you gave up your seat to. His name is Colin Stifler.
I'm just worried that, you know, if it doesn't prove to be as efficient of a user experience as I hope it will, once the flares kick in January, I wonder if it might cause me to reassess whether or not I would like to take it.
So it's $3. Yeah. It's free now, but it's $2.20 in January, maybe. And aren't they talking about possibly increasing that because no one's riding it?
It's $2.20 for now. I haven't heard that. The students at Johnson C. Smith and Johnson & Wales and CPCC might be able to ride it as much as they want because they'll build the cost into their student fees. But his whole point is with the bus and to a lesser extent the light rail, you have a good idea of when it is going to arrive. For the streetcar, you kind of have no idea if it's going to pick you up in 2 minutes or
but
if
why?
It's
stuck. Is that just because this is something new and they haven't figured it out at the transit system? Or is this something that can be easily fixed if they just study ridership patterns?
The hope is eventually they'll have an app that can predict when this will arrive. But keep in mind, the streetcar's in traffic. Somebody could hit it. Somebody could leave a scooter in the middle of the track. Someone could park horribly and cause the streetcar to have to stop. So that's the worry, is that this mode of transportation becomes too unpredictable that it's not worth spending $2.20 every day.
Was it worth spending $150 million on?
I'm not going there.
Okay. I think, though, that
Charlotte
really has to deal with the fact of public transportation, because with all the different apartments and people crowding in, it's going to be untenable, actually, to have everyone have to have cars.
Opening day jitters, perhaps, that is stretched on for a couple of weeks. Joe will follow this story for you. He's on the streetcar right now, in fact. We're talking again about voter ID in North Carolina. A 3-judge panel of state superior court judges overturned voter ID on a 2-1 decision, the state's 2018 photo ID law this week. Why? Haven't we already done this once before, Steve?
It seems like we do this like every 2 years for the last 10 years. I mean, there's just constantly a photo ID ruling. This latest setback for the Republicans will appeal to the State Court of Appeals, and then that will be appealed either by the Republicans or Democrats to the state Supreme Court. It's possible we could have a decision before the November 2022 election. But even if Republicans lose this round entirely at the state Supreme Court, it's not over. This is in the state constitution. They will come back and write a new photo ID law to try and pass muster. It would presumably be more lenient, allow more forms of ID, but this is it's not going away. I mean, we will be here talking about it in 2022, 2023, et cetera, et cetera.
The court said, the redistricting, redrawing of the maps, that this disenfranchised or targeted African Americans, which is why they struck it down. This voter ID law, for those who don't remember, came to be because we voters, 55% of us, said, yes, we want voter ID in the state, but they hadn't written the law at the time we said yes. They said, vote for this and we'll write the law. And that's what happened. Would we have voted for it, do you think, if they had written the law and put that in the referendum on the ballot?
You know, that's a good question. The first go around on voter ID back in 2013 was really strict. That was thrown out in court. This law was more lenient. More IDs are allowed. It's considered by a national organization a non-strict photo ID law. So there's that. But yeah, photo ID, this is one that for Democrats, it's really frustrating because it is a big issue for them. And yet like you said, 55% of state voters voted for this. That means a lot of Democrats went along and supported this in theory, even without knowing much about it.
I think on paper, if you say it looks like you, it, should you have an ID, a photo ID, it says sure. But then when you look at the particulars and you look at the fact that actually there is no instance, very little of voter fraud, people showing up to vote for someone fraudulently, that people think it's a solution in search of a problem, particularly when an earlier iteration of this law was judged by the courts to go after African-American voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. And it does seem as though they keep coming back at something. And it looks as though it's a part of this national movement to try to have restrictive voting laws and try, instead of trying to make it possible for more people to participate in voting and in democracy.
I have just a couple minutes left, but Mary, you wrote a column for Roll Call this week that cited Sinclair Lewis's 1935 book, It Can't Happen Here, which for those of us who don't remember, because it wasn't in the book club last week, it was about a U.S. president coming into office, a charismatic figure with the capacity to bewitch large audiences and who proceeds to turn America into a totalitarian dictatorship. This book came out in the 30s, mid-30s. That's when Mussolini and Hitler were coming to power in Italy and Germany. And your article is subtitled, It Can't Happen Here Until It Does. But it's not necessarily about Donald Trump. It's about dysfunction and climate change and the pandemic and threats to democracy. In other words, almost everything we're facing today on a daily basis. Share some of your thoughts.
Yeah, I just feel that most people don't want to look at a crisis until it's knocking at their door. And in this case, we have several huge crises, such as climate. Well, you know, people called Al Gore an alarmist, and now we have coastal floods and fires and droughts. And also when you talk about COVID and a pandemic, we have people turning to horse medicine instead of listening to the experts. And when it comes to democracy, we had an insurrection and we still have these efforts around the country of having audits to relitigate the 2020 election when everyone says it was free and fair. And many people feel, and Sinclair Lewis was my college roommate's field of study, so I gave her a shout at.
You are among several columnists just in the last 3 days who have sounded these alarm bells saying we're not paying attention. It's already underway. Beware. And is anybody listening? Very quickly. Very quickly.
Yeah. Is it? I'm not sure anybody is. Okay. I'm not sure they're taking it seriously until it happens. And that's my fear.
You wrote a story this week, Eric, about something we've heard before. The first sentence of your story had a familiar ring to it. Momentum keeps building. And you were talking about the Eastland Mall site. Good heavens, what's going on now?
Well, the master developer says that there's that word again, momentum, and they feel like they're getting very close to actually having some things happen out there, including groundbreaking perhaps by the end of the year. So we'll see, Mike. This is one of those eternal topics for this show, so we'll see if there truly is momentum.
Later today, today being Friday, for those of you listening on Saturday, we'll unveil the new Druid Hills Way street signs as part of the Charlotte Legacy Commission's effort to rename streets formerly named after so-called heroes of the Confederacy. What else do we know about what will be happening at this ceremony today?
Well, we know that Davis Street will officially become Druid Hills Way. This is one of several streets that will change over the coming months. The biggest that most people know is Stonewall Street in Uptown, and public feedback will be gathered very soon to decide what the new name of that street will be.
In fact, in the memo inviting the media to this event, they say they give you an address on Jefferson Davis Street, which they say can be used for GPS directions, which made me think about how quickly those directions can change if they change the name of the street. That's another story we don't have time for, however.
Yeah. It's a process, Mike. It's a process.
Yep. Thanks to Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.